This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts. This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the worlds of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or stream us live on YouTube and Bloomberg.com.
Diversity washing, it's apparently a thing. It has to do with CEOs talking up diversity and how they benefit ultimately the most. And this story is in the upcoming new issue of Bloomberg Business Week.
Yeah, it's out on newsstands today. It's online at Bloomberg.com/businessweek. It's also on the Bloomberg terminal. Let's get to it with Bloomberg News managing diversity reporter Jeff Green, who joins us on the phone from Michigan. I got to tell you, Jeff, I've heard of greenwashing, but I had not heard of diversity washing until reading your story today. So break down what it is and how it's defined.
Yeah, it's a pretty clever work by David Larker at Stanford and some other folks. They took what people have been saying in regulatory filings about their diversity efforts, and they put that together with what they're actually doing in terms of the diversity of their company, or their, like, are they getting a lot of fines from the EEOC for doing bad stuff? And they kind of picked out the people who had the biggest disconnect between what they were bragging about and what they were actually doing, and they called that diversity washing, and it turns out it works.
In other words, what does that mean? It works.
Well, the people who talked it up a lot, even if they weren't doing much, tended to get higher ESG scores than the people who were kind of speaking in line with what they're really doing. And then those ESG scores allowed these same companies to then get picked more often than the others to be in socially responsible investment funds. So, you know, at this point, until somebody can actually see what you're saying more clearly, it's a pretty good tactic.
Well, so maybe attracting in investors, but it also helps boost their compensation as well, right? You guys note this as well.
Yeah, there's a separate study from Harvard where by adding in compensation to the CEO pay, you as a factor, they get a bonus, but you can't as an investor really tell what that means, for the same reasons they can get people to invest in them, even if they're not really doing much in terms of diversity.
So this is stuff that you track in your role, Jeff. And, you know, you guys have done some great work in terms of tracking numbers when it comes to diversity, when it comes to what companies are actually doing. What do companies talk about when they say they're doing this stuff versus what they're actually doing? Like, you know, the proof is obviously in the data and it's in the numbers, but what are companies saying versus what they're doing?
Well, they just use a lot of the fancy words that everyone wants to hear about. You know, we're going to do more to make our leadership more diverse. We're going to try to retain and hire a more diverse workforce.
Is it always about what we're going to try to do, or like what we're trying to do? Is
it
about what they're doing
in the future? You know, I mean, the problem is there's no way to know for sure. I mean, there is no universal requirement that companies publicly report what they're doing on diversity, so they can pick whatever they want in whatever format they want in any way they want, and that is the problem.
You know, this is I do feel like, and we say it a lot, Jeff, is it does feel like ESG is going through a reckoning. And, you know, Tim and I talk about it's not going to matter until you really have metrics that you can apply to company to company to company. And then when a company reports their quarterly, that's part of the assessment, and they get rewarded or penalized, you know, if they don't meet those ESG metrics. But I feel like we have a ways to go. Where are regulators on this? How does the SEC, if that's the body that should be in control of it, how are they moving forward to figure it out?
There really hasn't been a concerted effort to get at this. I mean, to be honest, we could fix this tomorrow. Every company puts out what they call an EEO-1 form every year, shows the gender and racial breakdown of their entire company around, like, 9 or 10 classes of workers. They have to do it every year. They do it, but it's private and they don't have to release it. And maybe a couple hundred companies are, but not, you know, tens of thousands. So if everyone just said, here's our EEO-1, we could really start to see company to company what's going on. But companies are uncomfortable with it because, well, they say that they're outdated and they don't capture things correctly, but also they tend to make them look bad.
Jeff, for someone who does this day in and day out and knows the research, knows what's going on, I mean, how difficult, though, is it in terms of reporting to kind of call a company out?
Yeah, I mean, you got to they got to call themselves out, to be honest. It's really difficult unless you got a whistleblower to know for sure what's going on. And occasionally, you know, ironically, the companies that are most open are the ones we can call out. So the companies that are actually trying to play by the rules are the ones most likely to get burned by this. And that's kind of, I guess, the price they pay, because they say, well, we're trying to set the tone, you know, to get other companies to follow. But most of the time, what it means is they're going to be the ones out front getting their, you know, the whack-a-mole is going to get them first.
Isn't it a little concerning that this is the results that we see from the study, and now it sort of gives companies an idea, okay, wait a second, if I just keep doing this but not actually making any change, then it'll continue to benefit me?
Yeah, I think they've already been doing it. I don't think anyone can not talk about this on their calls. So it's always going to be a question of, are they actually doing anything? And we are kind of in a time when employees will notice. I mean, you can look around. You can look around your workspace and see whether it's working or not. So this isn't something that's impossible for people to know. It's just, as the pressure grows for companies to disclose, there's more information available. It's just not apples to apples. So you really can't compare across the industry. Like, is this good or is this bad? I have no idea.
Where's the ethics, though, in all of this? Like, I'm thinking about, if I'm heading a company and I'm saying I'm doing X, Y, Z, and then I kind of know it's just a lot of fluff and talk. I feel like coming off the pandemic, I feel like coming off of the murder of George Floyd, like we were having some fairly honest conversations with leaders, and maybe they felt like they were more comfortable to do so, but about diversity and some really important issues. And I really felt like that there was a sea change. Now I'm not so sure. So where's the, you know, the consciousness of, wait a minute, if I say I'm doing it, I need to be doing it.
Well, I mean, I think the sort of the issue here is this is marketing. I mean, we've actually done stories where we looked at it, and the very first sort of area where you see this come in is people with a marketing background, not people with a science background. We wrote some stories about this, but it may be shifting, but by and large, this is marketing. And it's just like any, you know, how many commercials do you watch and go, oh, that was very honest. You know, buy our beer, it tastes bad, but it, you know,
I've been called naive before, Jeff. I get where you're going.
Hey, Jeff, what does this say about ESG? Because that's a big part of the conversation that we've been having in recent months. And I think it's come to the fore because really, you know, in a down market, you start to see kind of a lot of different and hard truths. What does this say about ESG and the relationship that ESG has with what companies say about DEI?
I mean, it's well past time that people start to have some real conversations about this. We're asking people to change like the entire economy of the world based on some assumptions and asking them to do a whole lot of stuff. And up until a few years ago, it was just puppies and rainbows. I mean, it was just, yeah, we want to save the planet. We'll do whatever it takes. And now we're starting to actually decide we're doing those things. We're setting goals. And I think it's a good time to have people say, A, what are you actually doing? And B, is that really going to result in what you say it's going to result in? And what is the trade-off? And having like real conversations. This is, you know, like I said, it's marketing, but it needs to be science. So, and we're not there yet. We're not even close to that yet.
Hey Jeff, one thing I do wonder, and this is another thing Tim and I talk about, you know, when the market's doing really well, it's easy for people to be gung-ho about ESG initiatives or, you know, companies coming out and saying we're going to do these diversity initiatives and so on and so forth. But I feel like when recessions come or economic slowdown, everybody pulls back. Are we seeing that kind of momentum happen again, or are people understanding, wait a minute, we got to say we're going to do better and actually do better?
Well, until that unemployment rate gets higher, I think it's difficult for companies to make those kind of decisions. And also, I mean, it's the kind of thing where you know, again, you need to hire people, and people are that it's really hard to kind of stop at that level of like the only risk I would say the biggest risk is the first in, first out. Companies tend to be hiring more diverse now than they used to be. So in theory, if those 10,000 people leaving, you know, at Microsoft are from the first, you know, the group that's most recently in, then yeah, you're going to see a dent. And you know, a lot of stuff what happened at Twitter, you know, we wrote that, like we think that could see a dent. So it's the kind of question of, you know, who are you cutting loose in a recession? And does this worker shortage actually go away? It seems like we're still missing a couple million workers that we need to make this, put the power back in the hands of employers.
30 seconds, Jeff. What needs to happen in order for permanent change to actually take place at these companies?
Show us the numbers. I mean, just show me real numbers that I can compare across the industry, across the country, across everything else, and then we'll know. You know, it's there. You have it. You already collect it. Just show it.
Right. Transparency, right? It would change things dramatically.
Also, it would be great for Jeff's job. Get those data. Exactly. Get those numbers.
Jeff's like, please.
I need to see
it. A little selfish, but it's still what's...
We want to see it. We all want to see it too, Jeff.
Selfish for a good mission. Yeah. Jeff Green, thank you. Bloomberg News Managing Diversity Reporter Jeff Green joining us via Zoom from Michigan.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Tim Stenovec on Bloomberg Radio.
We do want to get to another story that's in the new issue of Bloomberg Business Week. It's also the Bloomberg Big Take. It's about the faux meat frenzy that's feeling more like a fad rather than a food fix.
With her cover story, we've got Bloomberg News consumer reporter Dina Shanker, along with Bloomberg Businessweek editor Joel Weber, both right here in our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. Joel, where's the beef?
Well, the beef has always been there. What hasn't been around forever has been the fake meat. And about a decade ago, Impossible Burger started to make some noise, and then along came Beyond Meat. And when Beyond Meat went public, that IPO was the biggest IPO since the financial crisis.
That was wild to read that. I had no idea.
And so that was all really interesting. And I think consumers were beginning to think like, hey, this is the future of what meat's going to look like. And then I think, the pandemic, more people tried this stuff. And then you throw in a little inflation and grocery bills going up. And then, oh, by the way, what's this fake meat stuff made out of? And the companies have hit some headwinds. And what really caught my attention and our attention at the magazine was Dina's all-star reporting throughout this. And the headlines that were starting to resonate with me were about the fast food stuff. Because all these fast food companies suddenly were like, wait, why isn't McDonald's doing this? And why isn't anything permanent on the menus? And so we started talking to Dina about, what's going on with fake meat? And it turns out that, there was a moment where fake meat was in a hyper growth mode, and it's beginning to look more like that fad, right, Dina? Take us inside your reporting. What'd you learn?
Thanks so much. Yeah, it was, it's been years in the making because, as you said, that IPO was huge and everyone was excited about it. I mean, the entire industry, suddenly you had like the small new startups that were coming up that were getting tons of funding because everyone saw opportunity here. You had the big food companies coming out with new products or reinventing old ones. Everyone wanted a piece of this because everyone thought, yeah, we can convince meat eaters to sub something else in. But it turns out that that's a really hard sell, and it's going to get even harder if the food doesn't taste quite as good, and it doesn't. According to most people that you will ask about it. It's also more expensive. And then, yes, environmentally, these things are so much better for the planet, but most people aren't buying for the planet. They do care about their health, but then turns out these products are not healthy. Now, some people might say they're marginally healthier, but even that is not settled. So consumers just really started backing away, and we saw sales plummet at the supermarket, restaurants, just everywhere, basically.
Go ahead, Carol.
Well, and this is something we've been talking about it before we got going, is for me, like, if it was healthy, I'd be a buy-in. I mean, what exactly is in it? I mean, I know there's a lot of sodium, right? Not good. What else?
So these are ultra-processed foods, which means that the ingredients themselves are processed or they're extracts of other foods. So that means the ingredient list... Are they so crazy compared to other things in the supermarket? They're not. There's a ton of processed food out there.
Right.
But
which I also don't eat.
Yeah, exactly.
Most of the time.
And that's exactly right. And so if you're trying to appeal to health-conscious consumers, those are exactly the consumers who know to flip the package and look at the ingredients and look at the nutrition facts.
Okay, so that actually speaks to an interesting thing here, because the audience for this has, when you look at it, it's like, okay, well, if it's fake meat, that means vegetarians would want this, right? But how's it gone over with meat eaters versus vegetarians, since those were the two categories of people that they're trying to get here, right?
So vegetarians and vegans buy the most of this stuff per capita. But at the same time, some of them are not really so into it either because they're not really looking for something that is that close to something meaty.
Yeah, like, I'm a vegetarian. I don't want to see the food bleed. Right?
There are plenty of vegetarians that like meat, but they have other reasons for animal welfare reasons, environmental reasons, and these are appealing to them. And they're probably the best customers. They're buying the most of it. But then you also have the meat eaters, and meat eaters just don't buy with regular frequency. They kind of dip in, dip out. A lot of people, thought I'd like to cut down my meat intake and tried these. Some of them said, okay, well, that was okay. And then they got comfortable with the idea of something like lentils or beans, which is also a lot healthier and cheaper. Other people were like, well, nah, I'll go back to, I'll have some chicken because chickens, I know chicken is healthy and it's a lot less expensive than beef and less expensive than this stuff. So the consumer base is just really very narrow.
What is it about food fads that gets people so excited? And I'm old enough to remember like the Snackwell's fat-free food craze, which you mentioned, the Olean / Olestra stuff in potato chips, which I remember my dad explaining to me what that was. I mean, that was supposed to be really exciting. And then after a few months or a few years, people start to realize, wait a second, this isn't good for us. It's like we haven't even learned this.
We're all just really obsessed with the idea of looking good and also want to eat all the time. And so anytime somebody can offer a solution that sounds like it will let us be both of those things, we all jump on
Why
it.
Why are you looking at me, Carol?
Just
okay.
saying.
Okay, one thing I do want to ask more about. The article is ultimately about two different companies, right? Beyond and Impossible. And Beyond's the publicly traded one. And we talked a little bit about that IPO before, which – you know, just to rewind the clock a little bit and like think about how rosy of a picture it was. In 2019 in July, stock hit all-time high, $234 a share. Right now it's trading at 14. So gives you a sense of how much enthusiasm has come out of this space. But so what do the prospects look like for Beyond, and what about Impossible, which is still privately held? So two strategic differences, I think, here.
Yeah, companies obviously with a lot in common, but also that operate very differently. Beyond has a lot of issues that I wouldn't attribute to the category or to consumers. They have a really hard time executing, and we've covered that for a while. They've had a really hard time bringing costs down because of that. Their leadership is constantly changing, so they have their own problems. Impossible is private, so of course we don't know the same level of detail about their sales. We do know their supermarket sales are way up for 2022. They went up by more than 50%, according to the company. The way they did that was largely by just adding more and more products, which is a tried and true food strategy to get people to buy more things. You know, you just... In two ways. One is that the more products you can put on a shelf, the more likely a consumer is going to notice them. You know, when a yogurt company has like 15 flavors, it's not because they think every one of those 15 flavors is going to sell well. They want that space. And then whichever one of those products do sell well, they'll hold on to and they'll keep cycling in and out of innovation. So that's what Impossible is doing now in supermarkets. And it makes total sense because their CEO comes from Chobani and has all of that experience.
You know, the thing about feeding the world and that the, you know, meat, what it does to the environment, to our, you know, earth, and especially as the population continues to grow, there is something to say that we've got to figure out some agricultural innovation, right? And food innovation. Is it just a case that they need more time? Am I missing something? What do folks say? And we just have about 30 seconds.
I think if it were me, I would never depend on consumer behavior for big changes because this country has, 300 million consumers in it, and that's a lot of people to expect to change their behavior. I'd try to get corporate behavior to change because there's many fewer corporations.
Lab-grown meat, yay, nay?
Likelihood to happen, I'd say nay.
Let's really? Keep reading about it more, you know? Like, there's more to, you know, put on a petri dish and study.
I see another cover story. There's something about Dippin' Dots too in the story.
We didn't
get into it.
How do we
it.
Not talk about the Dippin' Dots?
I know the connection with Beyond Meat. You've got to read it because it's
a secret ingredient. Let's leave it at that.
Oh my God, I'm terrified. Dina Shenker, a killer story.
Thank you, consumer reporter
at Bloomberg News. It's the cover of the new issue of Bloomberg Business Week. Check it out. Jill Weber, our thanks to you, editor of Bloomberg Business Week. The new issue on newsstands on the Bloomberg online. This is Bloomberg.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas, begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive when bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Tim Stenovec on Bloomberg Radio.
I feel like a day doesn't go by that we don't talk about Tesla. I mean, makes me ask, how come Tesla gets all the love, especially when it comes to stocks collapsing in the EV space? Because it does seem like that's the only one we often talk about.
It does. I mean, let's just say Elon Musk does garner a lot of attention.
He does.
But, you know, one of our colleagues here at Bloomberg News wrote all about that, writing about just that and more, is Bloomberg News equity markets reporter Esha Day. She notes that, well, Tesla's epic stock price collapse has dominated headlines over the past year. For some of the smaller electric vehicle companies, the route has been even worse. It's a sign that investors see few attractive alternatives in the sector. She's right now in our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. So a couple of companies that you talk about, Lucid is in there and Rivian is in there as well. Before we talk about the differences, let's just talk about the damage, because it was actually a worse year for those companies than for Tesla.
Yes, and thanks for having me. Yeah, it was quite a terrible year for Rivian and Lucid as well. And, you know, we can discuss a lot of reasons why that happened, right? Like, we saw growth stocks across the stock market kind of getting decimated, but that does not really explain all of it. You know,
can we ask how bad they did?
Oh, of course. So if we go back from the peak, Tesla so far, at the bottom of it, which was like early this year, fell around 69%. Rivian and Lucid lost almost 90%.
Wow.
So that's, yes, decimated is the word, right?
Literally, yeah.
That's a lot. Yeah. So go back to what you were saying that in terms of the reasoning. I mean, how much, I think when we think about it, it's so easy for a big player like Tesla to come out, right? And then it just drags down the whole sector. But I also do wonder, this is where we need to be smart, and I feel like we often are at Bloomberg, is kind of looking at each company individually. I mean, can we lump them all in one pot?
That's a great question. Can we lump all EV names together? Definitely not Rivian and Lucid with Tesla, right? Like Tesla, we cannot deny the fact that it's still definitely the biggest EV maker out there. It's proven the fact that EVs are viable. People want EVs. It has also proven that it can produce EVs profitably. Rivians and Lucids of the world and many other startups that are out there, EV names, they haven't really been able to do that yet. Mm. So they are a group on their own, the EV, pure play EV startups. And some of the decimation, as I said, like some of the decimation we saw in their share price was due to the fact that growth stocks, especially unprofitable, super risky growth stocks, really saw the value kind of getting taken away as investors are looking for more safer investments. But these companies have troubles of their own, and those troubles are getting magnified when we are seeing a company even like Tesla really struggling with demand. If Tesla is having to cut prices by 20%, what does it mean for these companies that barely have any of their, like, any kind of scaling up production? How will they manage their margins?
You know, I'm looking up, I'm curious about, you know, companies like Ford and GM, companies that are established automakers who've seen different economic cycles, been around in some cases for more than a century, and they've weathered previous storms. And I'm wondering if, you know, it says something about the EV industry, if it says something about the auto industry, or if this is simply just a growth stock / you know, tech stock story. Is it about investors not necessarily seeing the opportunity when it comes to these upstart automakers and thinking, okay, Ford and GM and Volkswagen, that's where we're going to see the big numbers?
So I think the heart of the story lies in the fact that these companies are having a really bad luck macro-wise at a time when they're really not established at all. They maybe at
they're
one
startups,
point,
right?
Exactly. So, you know, Ford and GMs, they weathered really bad recessions, but they were already established companies. They had the economies of scale. They had profit on their balance sheet. Maybe not at that point, but they did. These companies have nothing. They were like these giant companies. Rivian at one point was bigger than GM in valuation, but that does not mean that they had the established machinery of an established company behind them.
And to be fair, both Ford and GM did finish down last year by 42%. So it's not like, you know, they were seeing an upswing while these other companies weren't.
No, it's a really good point, right? The whole sector in terms of what, right? Where, that we saw pressure. I'm looking at some of these numbers. Lucid began trading in July 2021. Equity value topped out at $91 billion in November that year. Rivian shares peaked just days after its November 2021 IPO, valuing the company at $153 billion, more than Volkswagen, despite Rivian having zero revenue at the time. Like, I know it sounds like what, but we understand this. Like, there was a point where Tesla wasn't making earnings any, you know, and then it did. What I do wonder about the viability, though, of maybe all of them, maybe it's just Rivian and, you know, Lucid that we need to think about, because the cost of capital has gotten more expensive. And so if they have to tap the markets, either the private markets or the public markets, it's more expensive.
Absolutely. And that kind of, again, like that is the main risk for these companies. For a Tesla, despite the 69% drop that we just talked about, it's still a $350, $400 billion company. It still has that access, that cheap access to capital markets and cheap access to capital that it can tap at any point. These companies barely do. I mean, Rivian has about $13 billion of cash on their balance sheet as of the end of September. And its valuation hovers around $15 billion. So it's basically trading slightly above the cash that it has on hand. And that kind of tells us how risky the market thinks these companies are. Cars, at the end of the day, are consumer discretionary. They're discretionary purchases. EVs are way more expensive, especially a car like Rivian. Rivian's cars are way more expensive than gas-driven cars. Mm-hmm. So when times are tight, those are the purchases that are going to be taken down first by consumers.
Yeah, but I guess the big picture here is that electric is the future. Internal combustion engine isn't. And the question is, who are the companies that are going to be leading this? And I think there's another question, too, about how investors value these companies. Are they actually valued as traditional automakers, or now they're realizing they should be valued as traditional automakers, or are they valued as tech companies?
Right. I mean, that is sort of the main debate that we have always had and still have on Tesla and its valuation. Is Tesla a tech company? Is Tesla a car company? Or is it like some sort of an amalgamation of the two, right? For Tesla, again, it still does not trade like a car company. Its valuation is still bigger than the combined valuation of GM, Ford, Stellantis, and even Toyota.
It's incredible, even with the decline.
Right. But Tesla has a lot of benefit behind it because of that significant market cap. Also because it had the beginner's advantage, right? Like it had like 10, 15 years of like a strong bull run. And it has amassed this massive, market value, which also is like a fundamental benefit of the company. The Rivians and Lucids don't have that. It could just end up being a timing issue for them.
Right.
It's not a bull market. We're heading into recession. EVs are the future, yes, but the going will be tough for the next couple years for this sector. Who can really go to get through that? That's the main question that investors have, and that's the million-dollar question.
A lot of questions with them beaten down so much, too. Do they become potentially a buyout target who somebody who just wants to kind of, especially when you have such a cash position for some of them balance, right?
That would be wild.
The market cap and the cash on the balance sheet.
Yeah. We're speculating, though.
I know. We are totally. Eshadé, thank you so much. Really appreciate it. She's Bloomberg News Equity Markets reporter. You can check out more of her story on the terminal.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas, begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world, and our lives can thrive. When bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
Keep driving, you crazy.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
We're just about 17 and a half minutes left in today's trading session. We've been bouncing around certainly on the equity side of things. We're off our highs and lows of the session. Charlie, of course, breaking it down. And then, of course, we get Netflix earnings after the closing bell. This is going to be a big focal point, certainly for our coverage here at Bloomberg. And we're going to do a deep dive into those results.
Before we get there, though, let's do a deep dive into today's trade and what 2023 has in store. If anyone can tell us, perhaps it's Hank Smith, Chief Investment Officer at Haverford Trust, based in Radnor, Pennsylvania, joining us on the phone from there this afternoon. Hank, how are you?
Good afternoon, Tim. I'm doing great, man. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you as well. It's good to have you with us. We just talked to Steve Matthews on our Bloomberg Economics team, and I was not wrong. It does sound like the Fed officials are saying the same exact thing over and over again. But they're doing it for good reason, certainly, because they want to make sure that their message is getting across. What's the message that you're hearing, Hank, and what's it telling you about what equities are going to do this year?
Well, look, I'm very encouraged by Fed policy because they are taking their inflation mandate seriously. Forget about the past mistakes. Let's look forward. They do not want to repeat the mistakes of the 70s that stop, go, that allowed inflationary expectations to continue to build for 8 years. So, yes, I think there might be a little bit more pain in the near term. But I think we should have confidence that they're doing the right thing and it'll be good for long-term investors to get inflation down. Also, anytime you go into a bear market, as we did in 2022, your return expectations have to rise. In fact, 85% of the time markets fall into bear market territory, returns are positive a year later. Add to that, we just had midterm elections, and since 1942, markets have had positive returns in the 12 months following midterm elections. That is a lot of data points to hang your hat on. Finally, two more items. Valuations are reasonable. Small caps and mid cap stocks are selling around 13, 14 times earnings. The equal weighted S&P 500 is selling at 13 times earnings. So we don't think valuations are a headwind. And then finally, investment sentiment really hasn't been this bad in decades. That's hard to believe that it's even lower. In other words, the bearishness level is greater. The bullishness level is lower than it was in 08, 09. I still have the bruises and scars from that period.
Hank, let me jump in for a second, not to be Debbie Downer here, but our Tatiana Darie, great column on the Bloomberg. I think it was part of our Daybreak coverage early this morning. And she noted only a mild earnings recession is priced into stocks. The good news is that the profit downturn hitting America may already be priced in thanks to how much analysts have dialed back profit forecasts. The bad news is there's a major caveat. If the economy lapses into recession in the second half, stocks probably have further to fall. The point is, analysts have not necessarily maybe priced that in, that the earnings estimates, the current estimates, are probably too optimistic, and that leaves open a door for the S&P 500 to drop even further than we're planning for now. How do you factor that in, or do you disregard that?
Well, I think there is a chance that the S&P 500 gets a lower low than the October 22 low. But again, our view is it's likely that we're going to have a recession, but it's equally as likely that it's going to be mild and brief. And look, the market, the stock market is a forward anticipatory vehicle and consistently bottoms ahead of when a recession ends. But if we do have a recession, it is likely that stocks go a little bit lower from these levels. But there's a chance that this recession is going to be so mild that they'll call it a soft landing.
But would you concede, though, that if indeed we're not – earnings estimates haven't come down enough and that things are worse than everybody's talking about. This is why you see kind of the trade that we're seeing over the last couple of days. People just don't quite know what kind of a downturn and how long it impacts earnings. If it goes on for longer than that, than what's being already priced in, that's more problematic for stocks, correct?
Well, that's it. Yeah, you said it correctly. The volatility we've seen this week is really a reflection of that battle between do we get to go into recession? Do we not? And how badly are corporate profits going to come down? But I mean, there are some tailwinds to corporate profits. One, the dollar is well off its peak. Mm-hmm. That should be good for multinational earnings. Corporations continue to do major cost cutting. Inventories are lean, and China reopening is going to be a positive as well. So, maybe even in a no growth or slight recession, profits will hold up better than one would think in that type of environment.
So, okay, so if this is what we end up with, if this is what we indeed see happening, Hank, then give us the sort of outlook of allocations and what we should think about in terms of equities and fixed income. Carol said it earlier today. You know, thinking differently, maybe about 60-40 portfolio this year.
Well, yeah, the idea that the 60-40 portfolio is dead is very near-term thinking. And I think there's a very good chance we've already seen the peak in interest rates, you know, with the 10-year treasury at 4.55% last fall. We might not get back to that level. But I think in terms of allocation, and this is really kind of timeless recommendations that one should always have the maximum exposure to equities that allows them to sleep at night, and that varies from person to person. And also in this environment, we still favor dividend-paying companies and companies that have a record of increasing dividends on a regular basis. That's how you stay ahead of inflation. I think there's going to be continued emphasis on quality through 2023, as there was in 2022. And there's going to be volatility. There's no question about that.
Yeah, that's for sure. There's some great coverage, too, about, you know, this low VIX that we've seen for this protracted period of time, what that potentially indicates about more volatility or maybe some downside when it comes to equities. Hank Smith, thank you so much. Chief Investment Officer at Haverford Trust, based in Radnor, Pennsylvania, joining us on the phone from there, folks.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or stream us live on YouTube and Bloomberg.com.
The Bloomberg Sustainable Business Summit returns to London on April 25th for a solutions-driven look at the sustainable business and finance landscape, looking at the latest trends in ESG regulations, supply chain innovation and transition finance. Speakers include leaders from CDP, Emirates Environment Group, Seedtrace, COA and more. Summit advisors include City Commercial Bank, Red Sea Global and Schneider Electric. Visit BloombergLive.com/SBS2024 to learn more.